This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The fact that this 160-acre wetland is here is, I would say, very much a factor in their having selected this as a nesting site.
You've been listening to a program called The Urban Naturalist. It is available through the Humankind website. Go to humanmedia.org and search on Mike Houck. His last name is spelled H-O-U-C-K. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, where shopping is an art, celebrating 40 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March 3rd through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com, and by Oregon College of Art and Crafts Studio School, offering classes and workshops for adults in book arts, ceramics, drawing and painting, fibers, metals, photography, and wood. www.ocac.edu/register. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11:31. Up next, it's Art Focus with host Joseph Gallivan.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Holly Andres. Holly is a photographer who produces dramatic scenes of domestic family life. Welcome, Holly. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
It's lovely to be here, Joseph.
So you have a show in Salem right now at the Hallie Ford Museum, and it's your first major museum show. How did it come about?
You know, it was about a year in the making, and it opened on May 30th.
And it runs through August the 4th, so we have a little bit more time to go see it. Did you make new work for the show, or was it a total, you know, retrospective?
Well, I'm probably not old enough or dead enough for it to be a retrospective, but right. It's definitely a survey of my most seminal series. Mm-hmm. And there is a body of three photographs that were made with the intention for this exhibition, but otherwise it's work that has shown before.
So your work is very heavily styled. You dress the people in the pictures and you set up a scene and you light it very specifically, and you're trying to create a narrative, in some cases using multiple pictures that people follow through. Just talk about one of those series that's probably the main one.
Why don't I talk about The Fall of Spring Hill? And certainly my work is cinematic and resides in the genre of narrative photography that, you know, pioneers such as Gregory Crutzen and Jeff Wall and Cindy Sherman are obvious influences. And to borrow a distinction coined by Jeff Wall, I'm a farmer rather than a hunter when it comes to photography, meaning that I cultivate an image that is really derived from my mind's eye rather than taking on a more conventional photographic approach like Cartier-Bresson and capturing the decisive moment. My undergrad is in painting and drawing, and I think that that definitely informs the way that I approach my photographic work. But The Fall of Spring Hill is a body of work that premiered in 2010, and it's a suite of 14 photographs that depict a linear narrative that was based on a childhood memory in which I recall when I was a kid, I would go to this summer church camp every year, and it was essentially facilitated by the stay-at-home moms. And there was this incident in which a young boy fell from a dilapidated play structure that was in the playground area, and he got the wind knocked out of him. And it was the first time I'd ever seen that before, and I remember being really frightened by his response. And an older boy, as I recall, carried him into the church kitchen, which was in the basement, and where the moms were preparing food. And at the end of the day, I recall that the mothers responded quite fiercely, and in retribution for this play structure having harmed one of their children, they went out to the field wielding sledgehammers and baseball bats and axes, and they deconstructed it.
Mm-hmm. They smashed it up.
They smashed it up.
Yeah, yeah. So that is visible in the sequence. You have the women doing watermelon in the kitchen, and then you see a kid, but you don't see him fall.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So I specifically didn't want to show the graphic nature of the child falling, but rather that moment before he falls. And the actual fall is demonstrated by a cup of coffee that shatters and falls to the floor in the kitchen. But I do show the catalyst for the fall, and that is this moment where a young boy is tenderly passing a caterpillar to another boy, and his arm is stretched out, and he's kind of shot from below, and there's this halo behind him of natural light. And then the very next frame, you see the cup of coffee that had shattered on the floor. So as with a lot of my work, whether it's violence or if it alludes to certain like sexuality, I like to keep the work implicit rather than explicit in an attempt to invite the viewer to have more of an interactive experience and for them to conjure up their own ideas and their own depictions in their mind of what may have happened the frame before or the frame after. I think that it can create a more stimulating and engaging viewer experience.
Mm-hmm. So people bring a lot of themselves to these pictures. For instance, there's the one with a boy sitting on the edge of a couch watching TV with his leg folded under. And you said that people had reacted differently to that than you expected?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, that's the power of art. People are always bringing their own personal experiences and connotations and associations. And once you make art out of the academic sphere, you have to kind of relinquish that privilege of being able to stand in front of your work and say, this is what this work is about, etc. But yeah, that work in particular, it's a young boy and he's sitting on the edge of a couch and his leg is folded under, and to some people it reads as though his leg is that he's amputated. And that is almost like a photographic, like a big photographic faux pas. If one of your subjects is, you've posed your subjects in such a way that they look like they're missing a limb.
that happens all the time on sports pages when they do runners.
Yeah.
The one-legged runner.
Right.
So you didn't notice that at the time?
It didn't occur to me. And still, when I look at that photo, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess. But when I look at that photo, I feel like, and by the way, the title of the photo is Calvin. I feel like it looks like a young boy sitting on the edge of a couch. People perceive things differently.
You said you're inspired by covers of Nancy Drew books, covers that were made in the 60s, painted or drawn covers, girls looking at, you know, surprising things with looks of wonder on their faces. And you have one of the pictures called The Secret Portal in the show.
Yeah.
There's a girl looking at a tiny door.
Yeah.
And it kind of looks like Alice in Wonderland. What's that connection with sort of childlike wonder in girls? Why do you focus on that?
I had read all of the Nancy Drew books as a child, as well as some of the different renditions of Alice in Wonderland. And when I was a child, the covers that I was familiar with were probably illustrated in the 60s or 70s, I presume. And I'd been talking with Fiona, who is my young friend, who's the subject in many of my photographs. And at the time, she was telling me with so much enthusiasm that she was reading the Nancy Drew books. And I, too, had read them. And I couldn't really recall the plots, but I remember that the images were really still nestled in my mind. And I'd been wanting to do a body of work of young girls that were empowered. And so I studied the book covers and used Nancy Drew as a both formal and a thematic point of departure. She still continues to be one of the few smart and courageous and curious role models for young girls. But at the same time, she embodies this dichotomy because she's still very docile and demure and fearful. And so I used that to fuel the work. So ultimately, the discoveries that my young girls are embarking on are metaphors for that precarious transition from girl to woman. And so while I'm employing suggestive iconography, such as skeleton keys or open bird cages or secret portals, they're psychosexual metaphors.
For what? Sexual awakening?
For that transitional period when a young girl is simultaneously both empowered by that kind of newfound discovery, but also there's an impending sense of threat and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. Our guest this week is the photographer Holly Andres. Holly has a show called The Homecoming, which runs through August the 4th at the Halle Ford Museum in Salem. You have a series called Backseat Vanitas, which is still life objects on the backseat of cars, sort of classic cars.
Well, that's actually my newest work, and I felt like, as with all artists, I think that, you know, we're always trying to grow and keep ourselves stimulated. And I wanted to see if it was possible for me to retain some of the narrative qualities of my work without actually relying on like a human protagonist, mm-hmm. or antagonist. And so referencing some of the iconic objects that might be present in my other series, or just objects that are embedded with connotations, I'm hoping to suggest a narrative where the viewer, there are these points of views in the back of the car where something has happened. And so one is a bag of groceries after presumably a car crash, and there's milk that's splattered everywhere, and there's food, and there's really lush fruit, and a crumpled up bag. And they're much like a Flemish still life. They're very theatrically lit in that kind of chiaroscuro way. And then there's another one that...
there's a birthday party one, right?
There is a birthday party.
The confusing one, because the cake, from what you can see of it, hasn't been touched, but the balloons are going down, and it's hard to know whether before a party or something went wrong and never got there.
Exactly. So the cake hasn't been touched, and if you look closely at it, there's like a thin film of dust over the plastic cover. So my idea was that it was on the way to a birthday party and something derailed and the car got abandoned, and the car that is filled with cake and balloons is now starting to show some wear. Prior to shooting that shoot, I was thinking, like, how can I create a film of dust on this plastic cake cover that looks authentic? And then my assistant was like, well, why don't we put it on a dirt road and, like, drive back and forth and kind of, like, kick up some dust and it will settle. So we're in far southeast, and I pull into this dirt road, and I did the same thing with the balloons as well. So I've got this big yellow, like really garish kind of classic birthday cake, and I take it out of my car and I set it down, and then I have this big bouquet of balloons, and I drive away as though I'm turning around, and all of a sudden this crowd of children come out of like the woodwork. And by the time I turn around, there's about a half a dozen children who are probably all under the age of 10 who have formed this half circle around this the birthday party, which they think, you know, someone just dropped off for them. And then, you know, I'm trying to explain to them what I'm trying to do. And that's probably a day they'll never forget and always wonder what that was all about.
Yeah, some of them will be making art about that in 20 years.
That's right.
Well, yeah, you have a nice way with kids, and you're good at sort of wrangling them in, you know, in your other birthday party series. Is there another side of you that is very different from that?
Well, I don't have kids, so, and, you know, clearly I'm really enchanted with the childhood experience, but I don't particularly feel like I have, like, a maternal instinct, and so thank you for saying that I have a gift or a skill with that, because... I've never really don't know exactly how to answer that, but let's see here.
Well, I guess photographers, you know, they either have that in a mall where they're taking pictures of kids, you know,
yeah,
or if they're out in the field, they don't usually need that skill, I think. You have your commercial work, which pays the rent. Wrangling all these people and kids, it sounds like a natural kind of training to be a movie director.
Yeah.
And you've made a couple of short mm-hmm. movies. What do you want to do that?
You know, what I like about film is that it engages multiple senses. You know, you can think about rhythm, and you can think about score, and you can think about juxtapositioning certain scenes and shots. But I really think that there's something magic about a static image and the stillness, and you have to approach it with, you have to contend with just your own beating heart when you look at a photograph. I am interested in film. I certainly don't want to rule that out. I'm so in love with photography right now. My mind doesn't really work in that way where I could think of, like, writing a script and creating a three-act, you know, kind of classic Hollywood structure of a film. I mean, I wouldn't rule it out, but it's definitely not an aspiration. Like, I certainly don't feel as though photography, making fine art photography or commercial photography, is a stepping stone to aspiring to be a filmmaker.
What kind of music do you listen to? And do you listen to music while you work?
I prefer to work in silence. The older I get, the more I am so sensitive. And when I'm working and I'm really trying to engage my visual senses, it's too sensational and it's too distracting.
So let's hear a piece of music that you brought in for us today.
Love, look at the two of us, strangers in many ways. We've got a lifetime to share, so much to say, and as we go from day to day, I'll feel you close to me, but time alone will tell. Let's take a lifetime to say, I knew you well, for only time will tell us so, and love may grow.
That was For All We Know by the Carpenters. So what was the significance of that Carpenters song for you?
So I grew up listening to my sister play the piano, and she also has a lovely voice, and we listened to the Carpenters a lot. And so for the opening of the Homecoming exhibition, I invited her to play a set of the Carpenters. And I think as far as a style of music or a musician, they most closely represent kind of the essence of my work, and that there's this charming, idyllic innocence that has, you know, an obvious dark and soulful underbelly to it.
So she played and sang.
She did.
Right. While people were milling around drinking wine.
Yeah.
So you're a big Instagram user. What's your name?
Holly Andres.
Oh, you got there early.
I did.
And you obviously love doing it because all your pictures are sort of happy or interesting, you know, and you'll get your phone out basically and take a picture of anything you fancy. So how does a professional photographer, you know, relate to that sort of instant kind of almost throwaway, but obviously not throwaway medium?
Well, you know, I have been taking snaps of that variety with my little digital camera for years. I used to just pack it around. And there were times in my life if I was going through kind of a dark time and I wanted to get out of my head and to be more present and visually perceptive, I would try to navigate through my life as though my mind was kind of a camera. And I find that the more visually perceptive I am, and the more that I can see the world with like beauty and wonder and pay attention to some of those surreal or ironic or uncanny moments, the more frankly fulfilling my life is. And so I would take these photos and then I would just download them into a folder, and they didn't really have a life beyond that. And then when Instagram came around, I immediately recognized its potential to have, you know, a forum to share your work, but then to also experience the greatness of seeing the world through other people's eyes as well. I know it's not going to last forever because all good things come to an end. But I feel like there have been several people who I have been followers on Instagram who kind of developed an affinity for their work, or they have for mine. And, you know, you double tap the screen and you kind of that suggests that you like their work. And then I've met them in person and have just walked up to them and referred to them as their username and just gave them a big hug. And I just like Instagram made a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's a lot of, I don't know, chatter from professional photographers as far as it, some of, I don't know, I guess some of the detrimental, I don't really understand the conversation, but that we're giving a work away for free or that it's cheapening the photographic experience because it's on an iPhone. And I personally think that having to contend with the technical limitations of shooting on an iPhone and still being able to pull off a photograph that transcends just a snapshot really reveals your technical prowess as a photographer.
You you also get to see what people think of your pictures, your own pictures. You see other people's pictures, but you get comments.
Yeah.
And you're pretty good at handling the commenters, I noticed. what's your formula?
I don't know if there is a formula. I guess I definitely think about the titles as a way of accompanying the images. So I definitely keep text in mind sometimes when I'm uploading a photograph. But in regards to comments, you know, I just recognize that it's being seen by, I can't really answer that question. I don't know. I just, whatever comes to mind, I guess.
And finally, what are you up to now? What, you know, what's next?
Well, I just returned from LA where I was, it was a really great trip. I was on assignment for the New York Times Magazine, and I also worked on a collaboration project with the artist Gary Baseman.
Actually, you did say you went to Sasquatch and shot for Teen Vogue.
I did, yeah.
Tell me about the way, what you were shooting and the way people reacted.
Yeah, so I was doing street style photography for Teen Vogue, and I'd been to the Gorge before, but I never been to Sasquatch. And I mean, don't quote me, but there's like tens of thousands of people who gather there every year. And it's a interesting community, and they're very much invested in creating this family. And because it's titled Sasquatch, the fashion has a real particular kind of flair that often involves faux fur and juxtaposed with bikinis, strange looks like that. So I was photographing girls who had, who caught my eye in regards to their fashion. And I haven't done this sort of work before. And so I didn't know if the crowd would be maybe too down to earth, or maybe too modest for Teen Vogue. But my experience was that I photographed probably, I don't know, I was there for 3 days, and I photographed maybe 250 to 300 girls, and I didn't have a single subject say no. And not only did all of them say yes, but I felt as though I was making their dream come true that day. Because anybody who I had approached was conscientious about what they were wearing. And so to be recognized for that and for it to potentially be in a magazine was very flattering to them. It was interesting, and their ability and sophistication in front of the camera was kind of disturbing at times.
It wasn't just the duck face. It was,
yeah, they'd been waiting for a moment like that. Yeah, it was great. It was really fun.
Well, what would they do?
They just knew exactly how to pose their body in a way to make it appear more flattering or sexy, and the way to angle their heads. And so it didn't require a lot of direction.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guest was photographer Holly Andres. Holly's show, The Homecoming, runs through August the 4th at the Halle Ford Museum in Salem. Thank you very much for coming in, Holly.
It's my pleasure.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and The Sound Outside, The Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tuesday night from 10 p.m. to midnight, KBOO brings you the Anjali and the Kid Show with DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. Post-national bass, folk, and urban